This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you very much. That was a very, for me, moving introduction. Thank you. I'd like to also thank all of you for being here tonight, and I'd especially like to thank Aaron Levy for making the visit possible. I've always actually had a fondness for Penn, a kind of fondness that began when I, in the early 90s, I spent a year at the Center for the Study of Black Literature and Culture. Some of you may or may not know that. And I'm very glad to be here. The presentation tonight actually is drawn from a small book I'm currently writing entitled Music on Bones, and toward about two-thirds, three-quarters of the way through the talk, I'll kind of explain what that title means and where it comes from. But it's a book on the relations between music and techniques of reproduction, memorization, and writing. The lecture that I'm giving tonight is a kind of companion piece to an essay I recently wrote called Lapsus Imaginis, The Image in Ruins. And I've marked the relation between these two pieces by incorporating a small portion of two of the theses that compose Lapsus Imaginis. In the long run, these pieces belong to an ongoing series of reflections on the relations among images, memory, mourning, and history. And I'll begin tonight's lecture with an epigraph from Georges de Quirico. And if somebody could get the lights, please. I don't need much, so maybe this should be dark. Oh, it's like one or the other? Oh, really? I don't know. Let me get the quotation, and then we'll start it, and then we'll see which one we pick. This is de Quirico from 1913. Music cannot express the essence of sensation. Light and shade, lines and angles begin to talk, and music, too, begins to be heard, that hidden music that one does not hear. A picture, for example, always has a music of its own. This is the mysterious destiny of all things, to have 1,000 souls, 1,000 aspects. In my picture, the music of shattered light, the sensation beyond music, is written in letters of fire. End quote. One. And you can get this on. And what do you think? Can everyone see? Okay. I've never given a lecture in such light. I mean, it's okay, one. Each time it is a story of what the eye can see and what it cannot. To say this, however, is simply to say that our experience of art is always an experience of the eye, of an eye that seeks to see where it does not see, where it no longer sees, or where it does not yet see. At every moment, we are asked to respond to a certain play of light and darkness, the light and darkness without which the eye would have no story. And we respond to the silence of this play by inventing stories, by relating each of these shifting images to several possible narratives. What happens, however, when our eyes meet what they cannot see, or when they encounter what cannot be encountered? What might this experience of blindness and shadows have to do with what makes art art? In what way is sight essentially linked to an experience of mourning, an experience of mourning that mourns not only experience, but sight itself? Why is it that only the most profound mourning can become music? Why is it that music is perhaps most expressive only in the silence of the night? As the works of Salvatore Puglia would have it, from the moment a technology of the image exists, these questions tell us that sight has always been touched by the night. It is inscribed in a body whose secrets belong to the night. It radiates a light of the night. It tells us that night falls on us. But even if it were not to fall on us, we are already in the night, as Derrida puts it, as soon as we are captured by optical technologies that have no need for the light of day. We are already ghosts. In the nocturnal space in which the image that we are about to seize is produced, it is already night. Moreover, as we know that, once taken, once captured, such an image can be reproduced in our absence, we also know that we are haunted by a future that bears our death. Our disappearance is already there." End quote. If these works stand as a kind of homage to light, then, it is because they also celebrate darkness, a darkness without which light could never be experienced. If they take light as their theme, it is because this theme is shown to be indissociable from that of darkness. Or, to cast a more precise light on the matter, if the theme of these works is light, it is light as what withdraws from theme, as what cannot be thematized. This is why we could say our eyes are never captive in relation to these works. If they are captivated, it is because they are required and even mobilized. Puglia's works mobilize our eyes. They call them and animate them. They make them vigilant. With these works, our eyes undergo a kind of training, but not a training that would lead us to seeing, unless this seeing begins in the dark, in a kind of blindness. But what would it mean to see with our eyes closed? Why is it that Joyce so often asked us to shut our eyes in order to see? The entire logic of our relation to the world can be read here, and it can be read as the logic of art. Like the world, the work of art allows itself to be experienced only as what withdraws from experience. Its experience, and if it were different, it would not be an experience at all, is an experience of the impossibility of experience. The work of art tells us that it is with loss and blindness that we have to live. It is precisely this exposure to the abandonment of sense that, according to Jean-Luc Nancy, composes our lives. The work of art that would remain faithful to this abandonment of sense, and therefore to the world from which it withdraws, would disengage the senses and the world from signification. It would expose us to a whirlwind of images, none of which are ever one, in which we could no longer find ourselves, in which art could no longer find itself. Refusing to remain a single art, Puglia's works often take place at the intersection of painting, photography, sculpture, literature, and music. It would expose us to a proliferation of views, in this instance, offered by multiple immovable panels, which refer to nothing. These views would not only give us nothing we could see, but they also would see nothing. As soon as it takes place, the work of art, consenting to its own disappearance, vanishes. And in vanishing, in prohibiting its representation, it tells us that it never appears without its shadows, without its hidden faces, without the night to which it always returns. Two. My hand didn't go up. It's okay. We've got this routine. Okay, two. To encounter a work of art means to be exposed to time and images. But if the encounter withdraws us to the necessity of the disappearance into which art withdraws and from which it emerges, it is because works of art refer to time. What we call time is precisely the artwork's inability to coincide with itself. It demands that every work of art interrupt itself. Exposing the work of art to the movement of its disappearance, it exposes it to ruin, to damage, to annihilation. A movement of alteration, it conveys the exposure, the interruption and breakdown of the work of art, and thereby prevents it from being merely this work or merely a work. This is why a work of art is never already constituted, but is always in the process of its constitution. This is also why every work of art is a ruin. The ruin in the work of art is the law that forbids its own presentation. The work of art presents an interruption of history and does so only by interrupting the principle of presentation. Or, to put it another way, the disintegration of presentation exposes a caesura, a ruin in the presentation of historical experience. This ruin means that the work of art does not mean, does not designate anything, especially because it refers to time. To a time whose history is always a history of ruins or fragments. If time ruins or fragments the work of art, however, this ruined or fragmented artwork interrupts the movement of time in a manner that has not the form of time, but rather the form of time's interruption, the form of a pause, of a wound. This ruined work of art wounds the form of time. It suspends and deranges time, but since time and all time can be deranged in this way, time itself is perhaps a kind of madness. Like the work of art, it is never identical to itself. It can only be what it is by leaving itself, by abandoning itself. It is unrepresentable. Never something, never one thing, never this or that. It is what is never present. Nevertheless, as Kant reminds us, everything passes in time, but time itself. Time repeats itself endlessly. It begins in repetition. But what is repeated in time is a movement of differentiation and dispersion. And what is differentiated and dispersed is time itself. There can be no passing moment that is not already both the past and the future. The moment must be simultaneously past, present, and future in order for it to pass at all. This is why what is repeated in time is what is never simply itself, what is always incessantly vanishing. If time is a matter of repetition, it is a repetition only of its own unrepeatability. This aporetic exposition of time and the work of art prohibits a linear, unbroken representation of history. It presents itself as a repetition of the prohibition against images, a repetition that tells us that history can only emerge in the interruption of the continuum of presentation. The sign of this prohibition is legible in the several X's that punctuate Puglia's works. It is as if the prohibition that this X should express intervenes in its sign and makes it into a ruin of the sign that would correspond to the prohibition. By adhering to the prohibition, the very sign in which it could present itself is interrupted. The very sign of prohibition is prohibited. Especially because, as is so often the case in these works, there are fragmented images to be viewed as if behind a kind of screen within the two cross lines that form their X's. Puglia's works tell us that without interrupting the historical continuum, without blasting the techniques of representation, there can be no historical time. No history without the interruption of history, no time without the interruption of time, no work of art without the interruption of the work of art, If, however, this interrupted work of art is still a work of art, then work of art means the ruin of the work of art. It means that every work of art offers us ruin. The work of art, therefore, does not demonstrate. It is rather a monster of time, in which time does not properly tell time. It is, in the wording of Werner Hamacher, a monstrum without monstration. 3. What would it mean to assume responsibility for a work of art, for a history? How can we respond, for example, to the work and history inscribed within this work of art, especially when, before our eyes, it ruins the distinctions it proposes? It bequeaths to us a series of images in which we can no longer know what an image is, in which the image, temporalized and filled with history, never appears alone. It offers us a time in which we no longer know what time is, since it has been encrypted and broken within these fragmented, scattered images. We know neither what remains inside or outside the violated images, inside or outside the interrupted time, nor what images and time can be when they are ruined in this way. In exhibiting and archivizing remains, this work remains bound to the survival of the traces of a past and to our ability to read these traces as traces. That these traces are marked historically does not mean that they belong to a specific time, as Benjamin would say, but that they only come to legibility at a specific time. This is why they include reference to the past, the present, and the future, and in such a way that none of these can be isolated from the other. How are we to interpret this work, The Souls of Purgatory? This work is entitled The Souls of Purgatory. How are we to imagine it? What would responding mean here? Each detail of the work has its force, its logic, its singular place, the overlays of shadow, the varying colors of its several materials, the interrupted images from Alphonse Bertillon's 19th century anthropometric studies, The almost hidden image of the small boy dressed in a fascist uniform and raising his hand in a fascist salute. The multiple images of fascists taken in 1922, soon after they had taken power in Italy. The photographs of scientific experiments on gravity and balance. The hidden relations between men and animals. And the X's that so often encrypt Puglia's signature. A condensation of fragmented histories, images, and texts. This work, like all of Puglia's works, nevertheless remains linked to an absolutely singular event, and therefore also to a date, to an historical inscription. It opens a space for time itself, dispersing it from its continuous present. Looking both backward and forward, it asks us to think about context in general in a different way. What could responding mean here? How can we respond to the experiences commemorated, displaced, and ciphered by this work? How can we give an account of the circumstances in which it was produced, or better, of those it names, codes, disguises, or dates on its surface? How can we encounter a work that begins by departing from what is present, by bearing witness to the survival of the past, by experiencing the past as the future, as what is to come? How can we encounter, for example, what it says about the ghosts of fascism? Not only the ghosts produced in the name of fascism, the dead for whom fascism is responsible, but also the survival of fascism in the various historical, political, religious, or literary forms that today inherit its legacy. How can we respond to what is not presently visible, to what can never be seen within the work, especially when each of these panels can be turned around to exhibit another palimpsestic series of fragments drawn from several genres of archival materials? To what extent does what is not seen interrupt the surface of the work? Each panel is related to the others through its otherness. It is multiplied, serialized, displaced, turned about in all states and from all its angles, which means that these panels are not related, at least not in any determinable sense of relation. They are together, but togetherness here means otherness. It is what moves the image away from itself. While each panel could be said to take its existence from the series to which it belongs, each already bears in itself a kind of open seriality, a multiplicity, an internal distraction that prohibits any gathering around itself and remains faithful to the intersections between the visual and the linguistic, sense and form, trait and color, word and thing, and life and death. They evoke what Derrida has called, in reference to Puglia's work, another kind of synthesis, a shattered synthesis of an other writing of shadow and light, of an other schia fotografia, end quote. If the structure of Puglia's work can be defined as what remains inaccessible to visualization, this withholding and withdrawing structure prevents us from experiencing it in its entirety, or, to be more precise, encourages us to recognize that the work, bearing as it always does several memories at once, is never closed. The altering borders of the work are permeable and open. They belong to a process of transformation whereby the work, changing in response to the touch that turns its panels, to the movement of light that traverses and pierces them, withdraws from itself in order to mark its changing relation to its several futures. This means that Puglia's art is never made or to be made. It is rather the making, the tracing of the shattered memories and histories within which all things take place. The borders of such a work, therefore, are incessantly multiple and suspended. The shifting traces of light and shadow are at once the always changing limits of the work and the work itself. This is why if these works evoke a moment of crisis and destruction, part of what is placed in crisis is the finitude of the context within which we might read them. It is this crisis that for Benjamin constitutes the danger of reading. The image to be read, he writes, the image at the moment of its recognizability, bears to the highest degree the stamp of the critical, dangerous impulse that lies at the source of all reading, end quote. Suggesting that there can be no reading of an image that does not expose us to a danger, he warns us of the danger of believing that we have seen or understood an image. If history nevertheless breaks down into images, for Puglia, these images break down further into the shattered remains of multiple memories. Okay. 4. In what way do these shattered and multiple images enable a practice of remembrance? Can we say that this palimpsestic superimposition of several forms of inscription is still a form of memorization? What kind of memory is it if it can only appear through the medium of repression or forgetfulness, or through a process of ruination or fragmentation? In what way can shadows become figures for a kind of memory and reproduction that, remembering and reproducing images, texts, and traces, tell us that memory can never belong to a specific context or history? Puglia's works come to us in the form of signs, but signs that offer neither a historical record nor a legible image of the past. As Christopher Finsk recently has argued, the human figures that appear here remain anonymous, suspended in the notation, documentation, or graphic analysis, the reproduction of outline or the internal exposition by X-ray that overlays them or forms their background. They remain souls in a kind of graphic purgatory. This purgatory is perhaps nowhere better illustrated than in On Cranial Nerves, where each figure, hovering between type and individual, the images are from clinical studies, barely more than a sign and yet almost a portrait, seem imprisoned in an apparatus that multiplies its form by exposing it to a shadow play that redoubles the absence. These souls are the refugees of the historiographic, ethnographic, scientific imaginary with no escape from the image, end quote. Puglia himself describes the relation between the artist and his work in terms of the relation between the body and the soul as a kind of imprisonment or purgatory that torturously binds together life and death, shadows and memory. Citing Aristotle's text on Etruscan torture, he writes, "We live through tortures like the ones suffered by those who in an earlier time were killed in a very refined manner by Etruscan pirates who captured them. The live bodies of prisoners were tied very precisely to the bodies of dead ones in such a way that the front part of each living one was fit to the front part of a dead one. That is how these living men were linked to the dead ones, as our souls are tightly linked to our bodies. I imagine that one of these inseparable parts is the shadow," he goes on to suggest. "The shadow could be the memory. Indeed, memory holds us tightly. It keeps us from being severed from ourselves. It ties us to our own history in a faithful, sometimes too faithful, relationship to our identity," end quote. Leaving open the question of which of these inseparable parts is the shadow or the memory of the other, the body or the soul, the live prisoners or the dead ones, the artist or his work, Puglia points to a doubling or proliferation of shadows, a play of shadows that, composing and dissolving our identity, works to prevent us from imagining that we can ever remain faithful to ourselves, that we can ever identify ourselves. Interrupting the identity of the anonymous figures in On Cranial Nerves, this piece is called On Cranial Nerves, this sequence, the materials that traverse them are never directly related to this or that biography, for example. Puglia therefore responds to earlier efforts to bring together a physiognomic code for the visual interpretation of the body's signs and several technologies of visual representation. Emerging, according to Alan Sekula, in the mid-19th century, this system of representation and interpretation, often moving between physiognomy and phrenology, between science and medicine, proposed a vast taxonomic ordering of images of the body. From the efforts of Bertillon, the director of the Identification Bureau of the Paris Prefecture of Police, who invented the first modern system of criminal identification, to those of Charcot, the leading neurologist of his day, who, incorporating photography into his treatment of hysterics, left behind a series of medical photographs that could be interpreted as an exploration of the body in the age of technical reproduction. What traverses all these efforts is the desire to classify, to understand, to identify. Bertillon, for example, combined photographic portraiture, anthropometric description, and a highly standardized system of notation and archivization in order to identify criminals. Assuming that there were no secrets hidden beneath the body's surface, he sought to transform the body into a series of images and texts. Referring to Bertillon's claim that everything in police affairs is a matter of identification, Puglia notes in a brief text entitled Through the Image, Against the Image, that this obsession with identity and identification transforms individuals into cases, types, and emblems. He makes this point in another way when responding to the image at the end of Bataille's Tears of Eros of a Chinese prisoner undergoing the torture of a live anatomical dissection. He writes, "There is a cruelty in the act of photographing a human being. Whenever the figure is reduced to a sign with meaning, a schema, a diagram, there is such an act of torture." End quote. This is why we must oppose the pathos of intact memory, he goes on to say, with a will to save the unsaved, the unidentifiable. We shall restore to faces their veils. The uncanny should occur more in the sudden familiarity of the unknown than in the surprises of the familiar. It is a question of taking the head of the image and twisting its neck, of, in one's own turn, torturing the image. It is a matter of transpiercing the image as the only way of subverting photographic violence, end quote. Exposing the sudden familiarity of the unknown means for Puglia to suspend the abstraction that characterizes every photograph of the human form, or what Bataille refers to as the human figure in a 1929 essay by that name, fragments of which punctuate several of Puglia's works, and this work is called Human Figure. Staging the reproducibility of the human form assumed by photography and exploited by what he calls, following Bataille, the intellectual veracity of modern science, something he registers in Lavater's work in physiognomy, Gall's phrenology, Broca's craniology, Lombroso's criminal anthropology, Charcot's photographic iconography, and Bertillon's metric anthropology. Puglia seeks the unknown that makes us who we are by multiplying the image with shadows, with a superposition of texts and other archival materials in order to distance it from its capacity to represent, to distance it from itself, to make it strange, to expose it as a kind of secret. This secret or strangeness is reinforced by the suspension of these anonymous figures in a play of framing that including photographs, x-rays, texts, and the traces and inscriptions of scientific discourses on the body renders the human figure a series of unreadable signs. It is our unreadability, our loss of sense, that preserves our human figure as a sign, that presents our strangeness. It is what makes us monstrously similar to one another. To say this is not to penetrate a secret, to discover ourselves as a sign, for example, but rather to penetrate by it, to be penetrated by it, to be exposed as the secret. We begin, it would seem, in the intersection of body and sign that makes us who we are in our essential relation to otherness. This is why Puglia explains, if we speak of bodies and signs, we speak of anatomy. We speak of the body opening to allow the retrieval of signs. These signs can speak of themselves, or they can speak of the body that contains them. But above all, these can, for the anatomist, speak of other bodies. Therefore, such signs will make it possible to open up to the experience of other bodies and other things, end quote. The traced figures in these works offer this opening, the space seen by which we are brought into the world as the vestiges of monstrous signs. Puglia's works therefore use the strangeness of the human to make something like history or historical meaning possible. As Finz notes, this becoming sign of the human is irreducible to any signification and in its historicity the ground of any historical recognition. This abstraction produces an anonymous figure that is not an individual representation of humanity, but a figure of historical intelligibility at a kind of zero degree of signification, end quote. This is why, Puglia notes, his works are so often traversed and pierced by fragmented elements, phrases that are extrapolated, transcribed, translated into other languages, portions of words or letters, sometimes tiny pieces of torn archival material where only a few words are visible. There is always a dispersion, a spatial explosion, and isolated floating elements that, disarticulating the elements of representation or signification, are unified only by a kind of context, for example, color, end quote. It is in this way that these works bear witness to the world's fragmented strangeness. There is no witness for such testimony, however, as Puglia reminds us by using the title of Paul Celan's poem, Aschenglori, as one of his own. This piece is a detail of Aschenglori. This means that this testimony, these several acts of bearing witness, can never belong to the realm of knowledge. 5. A light that announces light's relation to violence, the X-ray penetrates in order to reproduce the interior of the body. Refusing to respect the same boundaries and laws to which visible forms of light adhere, it joins the principles of photography by making an image on a chemically treated plate to those of radioactivity by overcoming the resistance of bodies with rays. As Puglia explains in a short essay entitled The Art of Radiography, it is a kind of photograph or photocopy of what is hidden, of what is invisible to the eye, and with their alternating patterns of light and shade, the spectral images it offers the eye both enable and interrupt sight. Quote. Discovered in November of 1895, when investigating the emanations of a cathode ray tube covered in black cardboard, Wilhelm Röntgen noticed on the cardboard screen a faint luminescence. The X-ray would soon participate in the erosion of subjectivity. Since cathode rays were known to travel only a very small distance from the tube itself, Röntgen knew that he had encountered the effects of an entirely new kind of emanation. He placed various obstructions between the tube and the screen, including a book, wood, and various metals, and observed that only certain metals were capable of preventing the passage of these new rays. He then placed his hand before the tube and saw the image of his bones projected on the screen. Soon thereafter, he produced the first X-ray photograph, an image of his wife Bertha's hand. The image depicts Bertha's skeletal structure, the bones that constitute her hand, but also the wedding ring that hovers on the surface, tearing it from the outside. The trace of exteriority that Bertha's ring imposes on the interior dimension reveals the uncanny nature of the new medium. On seeing her flesh transgressed in this way, Bertha is supposed to have shuddered at the vague premonition of death it evoked. In the first paper he published on the subject, Röntgen designated his discovery the X-ray, a name that for him suggested the mystery of its nature. High in the electromagnetic spectrum, something that was not entirely clear at first, the X-ray's high energy, high-speed vibrations allowed them to penetrate almost anything. Linking the X-ray to photography by fixing his discovery on photographic surfaces, Röntgen sought to record the fluorescence that, passing through both organic and inorganic matter, left a shadow of the object on the plate. For him, the X-ray photograph was only a means for discovering the nature of its properties, but what seized the imagination of those who were fascinated not by the question physicists posed, what exactly was this new form of light, but rather what it made visible, were the images it traced on photographic plates. A majority of the articles that appeared directly after Röntgen's discovery bore such titles as On the New Photography or Photographing the Invisible. With the discovery of the X-ray, or as it was called soon after it was introduced in terms that highlight its proximity to the ghostly character of photography, the skiagraph, the shadowgraph, the desire to see the body's interior and to record it photographically came together. Since X-ray photographs are always viewed as negatives, their shadowy images, as Oliver Gaken explains, appear only when their negativity is held up to light. If we were to project an X-ray image on a screen, the interior of the body would appear as a figure of light. The X-ray makes flesh disappear. It makes the body transparent to death. It was exactly this capacity to make matter disappear that compelled Lenin to write against the philosophical significance of X-rays. Lenin doesn't write exactly against the X-ray. What he writes against is the way in which the discovery of the X-ray is encouraging people to talk about the disappearance of matter. Okay. In entering the body, it produces an image of its passage. It announces the age of radiation and all the deadly changes this age has introduced to us. If the photograph always refers us to our death, to our non-presence in the image, the X-ray produces death in the production of its image. Not only because of the danger of an overexposure to radiation, not only because the skeletal image the X-ray offers by treating matter as if it were invisible provides a vivid image of the photograph's proximity to death, but also because the X-ray exposes the body's essential relation to the signs of our mortality, to the living traces of our future death. When the light of the sun is set against the X-ray, surface appearances disappear to reveal the death beneath the surface of life. The X-ray provides an image of overexposure, an image that in viewing everything views the remains to which all bodies are destined. This identification between image and corpse, the being toward death of the image, is the focus of Blanchot's 1955 essay, The Two Versions of the Imaginary. If it is true that the power of the X-ray image, like that of the image in general, belongs to the power of death, to what Blanchot calls the power of the negative, then it is only from the point of view of death, from the point of view of bones and remains, that an image can be said to be possible. We might even say, because of this, that the X-ray's danger is that it offers us too much to see. Nevertheless, while the X-ray promised to obliterate the distinction between the body's inner and outer spaces, its ghostly images of the body's interior were subjected to different criteria within the sphere of medicine, where it was criticized for the imprecisions of its shadowgraphs. Radiography removes sight from the field of medical imaging, Gaken notes, since its images cannot be focused by a lens. While the camera seeks to create the illusion of the presence of a body in space and time, radiography charts objects according to their volumetric space by measuring density. No longer regarded as a window to the body's interior, its images reveal its relation to other technologies of the image. In particular, its divergence from the properties of visible light suggests that every image that results from the inscription of light demands to be read, end quote. What happens with the X-ray becomes lost in the shadows, and what is lit up is obscurity itself. We enter not a body that has now become transparent, but an obscurity that cannot be overcome. What the X-ray's shadows suggest, however, is the difference between the camera and the X-ray. The X-ray stares rather than blinks, and it is this staring, this duration of the X-ray exposure, that was always able to sear the bodies it recorded. This is why, before understanding the dangers of being exposed to the X-ray's gaze, patients risked being burned. As Akita Lippitt explains, sunburns, hair and nail loss, scaling of the skin, nausea, and an array of other pathogenic signs began to expose the destructive capacities of the X-ray. Under the glow of the X-ray, the body moved from a referent to a sign, from a figure to the primary site of inscription. X-rays turned the human body itself into a photographic surface, reproducing its function directly on the human skin. We might remember, however, that the legacy of photography already contained a version of this fantasy with regard to the human body. Nadar recounts, for example, that Balzac believed that the human essence comprised a series of specters, infinitely superimposed layers of foliated film or skin. According to Balzac, a layer of skin was removed and captured each time one posed before a camera. This is like the onion skin theory of subjectivity. The X-ray then could be said to have amplified the effects of a photophobia already at work in photography. This is why, as the dangers of the X-ray became more recognizable, the aperture of a blink gradually was incorporated into the machines that projected the ray. There remains, however, a monument to X-ray martyrs in the city of Hamburg, and this monument foreshadows the monument to the first nuclear explosion. The development of the X-ray's power in the field of nuclear physics conjures the lightning flash of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Lasting 1/15,000,000th of a second, the nuclear flash penetrated every building, leaving its imprint on stone walls, changing their apparent color through the fusion of certain materials. The same was the case with clothing and bodies, where kimono patterns were tattooed on the victim's flesh. As Paul Virilio has suggested, reminding us of the relations between photography and X-ray technology, light and shadows, bodies and writing, and encrypting a reference to the photographic resources of Plato's Allegory of the Cave. If photography, according to its inventor, Isidore Nietzsche, was simply a method of engraving with light, where bodies inscribe their traces by virtue of their own luminosity, nuclear weapons inherited both the darkroom of Nietzsche and Daguerre and the military searchlight. What appears in the heart of darkrooms is no longer a luminous outline, but a shadow, one which sometimes, as in Hiroshima, is carried to the depths of cellars and vaults. The Japanese shadows are inscribed not as in former times on the screens of a shadow puppet theater, but on a new screen, the walls of the city, end quote. Six, incorporating X-ray film into his works, Puglia tells us that we must regard death, that we must encounter the acts of mourning that compose our existence, that make us who we are. He reinforces this point in his early experiments with this medium by framing his pieces in lead, a metal known not only for its resistance to the X-ray, but also for its association with death. As Primo Levi reminds us in his 1975 novel, The Periodic Table, lead is the metal of death, because it brings on death, because its weight is a desire to fall, and to fall is a property of corpses, because its very color is dulled dead, end quote. Believed by the alchemist to be the oldest of metals, this metal of death is at the same time highly durable and resistant to corrosion, which is why it is used to line coffins for the dead. Its durability tells us, moreover, that it is difficult to corrode or diminish death. This is perhaps why Puglia uses lead to constitute, if not to systematize, his work. As Philippe Lacoulabart has noted, when Puglia encases what he exposes or shows, and it is always something archival, no matter what form it takes, words, fragments of texts, old photographs, reproductions of engravings, designs, manuscripts, X-rays, etc. When he encases all this in lead, when he protects all this in glass, he recovers or he invents, resuming and condensing through a kind of brief and involuntary citation, a very old gesture, that of the preservation of relics, end quote. All these relics, these remains, are secular, but what Puglia aspires to erect, or more precisely to install, is in fact a monument, a memorial, if you will, in the form of a reliquary. Suggesting the funereal and scriptural character of all works of art, Puglia's reliquary nevertheless remains malleable, like the lead that frames it. In framing his works with lead, he frames them with what both receives and produces marks, impressions, or signs. He frames them with a medium of writing, and thereby reaffirms their relation not only to death, but also to the future, since this lead frame encases, even as it remains, because of its malleability, because of its capacity for inscription, open to transformation. If a withdrawing figure remains as the signature of these works, we still recognize, encrypted within the movement of this retreat, references to some of the major figures of our modernity. Here an aging Hölderlin, there some word of Ceylon, here an excerpt from Bataille, there a fragmented or engraved text from Stendhal, Freud, Faulkner, or Rizzos, and above all, writing. Perhaps the last figure that emerges from the disfiguration that we believe to be everywhere. This piece is called As I Lay Dying, and it has fragments from Faulkner's text. The paradox is always that in showing the effacement of the figure, it is the figure that resurfaces, however heterogeneous it may be. This non-homogeneous figure is the focus of all the techniques set into play here, which are numerous. Multiple because, as Lacoulabart suggests, the archive from which Puglia draws his materials is infinite, corresponding as it does, despite the choices that must be made, with all of history. But this archive is not his own archive, nor his memory. It is of the archive and of memory. In the play of the figure, there is an act of courage, end quote. Puglia does nothing else than confront, systematically and rigorously, what produces all the difficulty of so-called contemporary art, the absence of the subject in every sense, an absence that does not result from disappearance or effacement, but on the contrary, from multiplication and proliferation. There are only subjects of art, and this includes us. 7. The body was born in Plato's cave, Nonsi tells us, or rather it was conceived and shaped in the form of a cave as a prison or tomb of the soul. The body was first thought from the inside, a darkness into which light only penetrates in the form of reflections and reality only in the form of shadows. An interiority devoted to images and to the knowledge of images, this body is the inside of representation and at the same time the representation of that inside. At times, the body is the inside in which the image is formed and projected, sensation, perception, memory. At other times, it is the signifying outside, in which case the outside appears to itself as a thick interiority, a filled cave, a property prior to any appropriation. As such, the body is the articulation of the sign. In Nonsi's words, it is for our entire tradition that in which sense is given and out of which sense emerges. This is why, he goes on to say, the body is the place of contradiction par excellence. Unquote. Either it is by the body and through it that signification occurs, and then signification falls within its boundaries and is worth only what a shadow is worth in a cave, or it is from the body and on it that signification takes shape and is deposited. There is finally no difference between this opaque darkness and the darkness of shadows. The body remains the dark tomb of sense and the dark sign of this tomb. In this work, Puglia entitles it Vanitas, to evoke, among other things, our relation to death and mortality. We are offered a row of vertical lines of small panes, a suspended series of x-rays portraying various skulls, another kind of cave or cavity, each of which is traversed by signs, symbols, diagrams, and notations. The glass plates are, moreover, engraved on both sides with fragments of texts in different languages. On one side, grammatical exercises drawn from French and German grammar books. On the other, fragmented excerpts from Faulkner's As I Lay Dying. If Puglia's works give us body parts covered with signs, it is because they exhibit the writing of a corpus divided from itself and from its sense. This is indeed what writing is, the body of a sense that will never tell the signification of bodies, nor ever reduce the body to its sign. We must not consider the anatomy of dissection, Puglia suggests, the dialectical dismembering of organs and functions, but rather the anatomy of configurations, of shapes, states of the body, if you will, ways of being in the world. In all writing, a body is traced. If the body is what cannot be read in a writing, however, unless we understand reading as something other than decipherment, it nevertheless demands the kind of writing that would enable it not to signify. The body does not belong to a domain in which knowledge or non-knowledge are at stake, any more than knowledge itself belongs to the domain of bodies. As Proust would have it, the body is what registers or records the traces of memories and impressions. An apparatus of memory, it finds itself, as Marcel says of the past, encumbered with innumerable negatives that, inscribed within it, remain undeveloped by the mind. That cognition and perception are dependent on the entirety of the corporeal sensorium means that memory and its negatives are irreducible to the operations of consciousness and therefore cannot be brought to light. To remember within the space of the remembering body is to remember without knowing anything. At the same time, the materiality of this remembering body is therefore not that of a simply physical exteriority, even if we can say that it is the body or flesh of thought. The body that thinks and remembers, as Proust puts it, with its ribs, knees, and shoulders, is like photography, an archive of memory. Receiving and producing impressions, it is a kind of darkroom, what Proust elsewhere calls an inner darkroom. This is why the body is never simply the body. It is also an apparatus. If, as Nancy writes, the body exposes the body, then there is no such thing as the body. There is no body. 8. Musica na kostiaki, music on bones. This phrase names an exhibition of Puglia's work in St. Petersburg in 1994. It also names a practice in Russia in the 1940s, 50s, and early 60s in which, in order to bring Western music into the country, dissident lovers of music first heated already exposed X-ray film, and then, pressing a master disc into the heated film, made a kind of phonographic recording, a crude vinyl transcription whose barely visible grooves were etched on chest cavities and spinal cords. What is remarkable about this practice, I mean, aside from the fact that it existed, sometimes called rock on bones or jazz on bones, depending on the genre of music being transcribed, is not the quality of the sound that resulted from the reproduction, which really was very poor, but the organization of several motifs and modes of reproduction: music, technology, photography, radiography, phonography, history, writing, memory, repetition, the senses, around death and mourning. What is perhaps most remarkable about the practice, then, is that it transcribes music onto a shadowy representation of our mortality, of our finitude. If we are to believe Malraux, however, music has always only been music on bones. As he writes in his 1933 account of the early days of the Chinese Revolution, the human condition, music only speaks of death. If on the one hand he suggests that of all the arts, only music can speak of death, on the other hand he tells us that music can only speak of death, can speak of nothing else but death. What makes music music is that in our experience of it, we encounter death. We encounter what is always about to vanish. But what exactly links music to mourning? What links it to the work or play of mourning? What links music to mourning and death? Among so many other things, its capacity to suggest its own fugitive, transitory character, to awaken the impossibility of our ever grasping it. Whatever we might call rhythm, especially in its relation to repetition and variation, is prior to the figure of the visible notations whose appearance, as such, is very possibility of being grasped or seen. It conditions. This is why music often has been understood as an art beyond signification. In the experience of music, we can always pass on anew to an ineffable oversignification. Music is, as it were, the least incorporated matter. After being heard, it still remains somewhere out there, hovering, resonating elsewhere at a distance, in an exteriority that extends in all the other directions, and the ear hears along with the music as the opening of the world. Music has no hidden surface. It is fugitive and evanescent. As such, it has the capacity to dispossess its listener. We might even say that music means the vanishing of the subject. Like language, music determines us by disappropriating us, by making us inaccessible to ourselves. To say that music has always been music on bones, then, is to say that music has always signaled our departure from ourselves, our imminent death. It is also to say that music has always been a form of inscription or writing. It has the power to leave an imprint, and it has this power because it is rhythm itself. When Mallarmé says in Music and Letters that every soul is a rhythmic knot, he recalls, as Lacoula Barthes has noted, the archaic sense of the word music. Rhythm, that is to say, seal, type, letter, character, scheme. This is why he can speak of the musicality of everything. Music implies the violent imposition of form. It is the impression that in some malleable matter or other makes an effigy appear. To designate an operation of this kind, the Greeks used the verb typin, from typos, the mark, the imprint, engraved characters. Benveniste confirms this point in his 1966 essay, The Notion of Rhythm in its Linguistic Expression. There, following Archilochos and Aristotle, when they comment on Democritus and the metaphysics, he notes that rhythmos means originally schema, form or figure, schema. As Benveniste says with regard to an example drawn from Herodotus, and he's interested in the relationship between music and the letters of the alphabet, it is not by chance that Herodotus uses rhythmos for the form of the letters at approximately the same time that Leukippos defines this word with precisely the same example. This is the proof that a still more ancient tradition exists that applied rhythmos to the configuration of the signs of writing, end quote. Benvenisi here delineates the contours of a question about the relation between music and inscriptions, a question on the basis of which it seems possible, passing through the works of Puglia, to circumscribe the problematic of the subject and writing. But we should not move too quickly through Benvenisi's argument. He insists that schema is in fact only an approximation for ritmos. His schema designates a fixed realized form posited as an object. Ritmos, on the other hand, is the form at the moment it is taken by what it is, by what is in movement, mobile, fluid, the form that has no organic consistency, end quote. It is, Benvenisi adds, improvised, momentaneous, modifiable form. The word rhythm already implies, then, the type, the stamp, the impression that conforming us in advance prevents us from ever returning to ourselves, sends us back to the night and chaos that, never schematized by us, enables us to appear as what we are, as what we are not, ourselves. In this sense, perhaps, every soul is a rhythmic knot. We could even say, we ourselves are music on bones. 9. Music and writing were born together. Although, as we already have suggested, we did not need to wait for the invention of the gramophone or phonograph record to learn this truth. Still, these inventions can be said to confirm this truth. As Adorno notes in his 1934 essay, The Form of the Phonograph Record, the most evident feature of these strange black-surfaced objects is that they are covered with curves, a delicately scribbled, utterly illegible writing, end quote. Like photographic inscription, Adorno adds, the record transforms the acoustic event it transcribes. This is why, like the photograph, it too is structured around an act of mourning. It mourns the live musical event by inscribing within its spiral the memory of a vanishing temporal experience. As Tom Levine suggests, the record as an acoustic photograph is a figure that even precedes and then follows the invention and early development of the phonograph. As early as 1856, Nadar had the idea of an acoustic daguerreotype that would faithfully reproduce sounds, end quote. Adorno, however, reads the destruction of the musical event's aura through gramophonic reproduction as the condition of possibility for the transformation of music into text. There is no doubt, he writes, that as music is removed by the phonograph record from the realm of live production and from the imperative of artistic activity and becomes petrified, it absorbs into itself, in this process of petrification, the very life that would otherwise vanish. The dead art rescues the ephemeral and perishing art as the only one alive. Therein may lie the phonograph record's most profound justification. It reestablishes, by the very means of reification, the old hidden and yet justified relationship between music and writing, end quote. Before the invention of the gramophone, Adorno explains, musical notation was an arbitrary system of mere signs. With the gramophone, however, music liberates itself from the constraints of such notation, from what Levine has called its long subordination to the dictates of marks on paper, unquote, and becomes writing. Through the curves of the needle on the phonograph record, Adorno tells us, music approaches decisively its true character as writing. Evoking what Moholy-Nagy already had called a record's groove script alphabet, he goes on to suggest, like Moholy-Nagy before him, that where music writes, there is no writing subject. This is why the gramophone record may in fact be, as Adorno seems to tell us, an allegory of art itself. Quote, the truth content of art only arises to the extent that the appearance of liveliness has abandoned it. Artworks only become true, fragments of the true language, once life has left them, perhaps even only through their death and that of art itself, end quote. Through the phonograph record, he goes on to note, time gains a new approach to music. It is time as evanescence, end quote. Music on bones, then. The art of time and death, the art of all art that refers to death and our evanescent existence, that points toward its dissolution, its remains. Rilke literalizes this point in a passage from his 1919 notebook, Primal Sound, a text made famous by Friedrich Kittler in his Discourse Networks. In the text, Defining Literature in Terms of Phonographic Inscription, Rilke gives an extraordinary account of the relations among music, death, and bones, relations that, as he suggests, point to the primacy of acoustic writing to the earliest sounds on record. 14 or 15 years after a particular day in school, he tells us, in which he made a phonograph out of cardboard and parchment paper, candle wax, and the bristles of a clothes brush, he attended a series of anatomy lectures at the School of Fine Arts in Paris. He became obsessed with skulls, and eventually acquiring one, spent the evening studying it, with the result that his childhood memory was completely rewritten. If it once seemed that sound produced by his phonograph would remain unforgettable, apart from us, preserved outside, he now came to believe that the markings traced on the cylinder of the phonograph were much more essential than the sounds from the funnel. The sutura coronalis motivates a shift from reproduction to inscription, from reading to writing. In the peculiarly vigilant and demanding light of the candle, he tells us, the cranial suture was quite evident, and I soon realized what it reminded me of, those forgotten lines that were once scratched onto a little wax roll by the point of a bristle, end quote. The suture that divides the two cranial hemispheres, like a sagittal incision, designates a kind of writing. It tells us that material inscriptions occur at the intersection of technology and physiology, that they bear an acoustic relation to death. Rilke writes, the coronal suture of the skull, this would first have to be investigated, has, let us assume, a certain similarity to the closely woven line which the needle of the phonograph engraves on the receiving rotating cylinder of the apparatus. What if one changed the needle and directed it on its return journey along a tracing which was not derived from the graphic translation of sound, but existed itself naturally, well, to put it plainly, along the coronal suture, for example? What would happen? A sound would necessarily result, a series of sounds, music, the primal sound which here makes its appearance in the world, end quote. Music on bones. Music from bones. 10. Ashes are the truth of the work of art. That there can be neither truth nor art without ashes means that both take place in a state of decay, in a state that moves away from itself in order to be what it is. Like the photograph that tells us what is no longer before us, truth can only be read, if it can be read at all, in the traces of what is no longer present. Like the sign script of transience that for Benjamin inscribes the word history on the countenance of nature, these traces figure not only the transitory character of allegory, but also the scriptural character of history. That both allegory and history are to be read in their transience means that their truth comes in the form of ruins. As Benjamin writes in Central Park, whatever is struck by the allegorical intention is severed from the context of life. It is at once destroyed and conserved. Allegory holds fast to ruins. It offers the image of petrified unrest, end quote. For Puglia, the history of the artwork tells us that all works are funereal. They bear an essential rapport to their finitude and indeed survive only to the extent to which they exhibit their death. In order to be art, then, it must also be the art of the dissolution of art. In the wording of Hamacher, it is only in the dissolution of its objects, representations, contents, and meanings that art becomes itself. In its disappearance, art exposes itself as its end, its own end, and preserves itself and can only preserve itself because it takes hold of itself as disappearance, end quote. There is thus no end of art, and there is, from the very beginning, nothing other than the end of art. The end of art does not cease to end. This is why we can say that there is no work that does not reduce its subjects to ashes. As Man Ray wrote in 1934 in an essay entitled The Age of Light, images are the oxidized residues fixed by light and chemical elements of living organisms. No plastic expression can ever be more than a residue of an experience. It is rather the recognition of an image that has survived tragically, recalling the event more or less clearly, like the undisturbed ashes of an object consumed by flames, end quote. 11. From the very moment of the event of the artwork, the work that telescopes history into a moment suggests that what inaugurates history is written into a context that history itself may never completely comprehend. This context exceeds the limits of its representation. To write history, to read or experience a work of art, is therefore not to represent some past or present presence. To articulate the past historically, Benjamin writes, does not mean to recognize it as it really was. It means to take possession of a memory as it flashes up at a moment of danger. History therefore begins where memory is endangered, during the flash that marks its emergence and disappearance. It begins where representation ends. For Puglia, encountering works of art means encountering the ruins left behind by shattering explosion of light, encountering the traces of what is no longer present. This is why, for him, ruins and traces await us. 12, and this is the last thesis. There can be no image that does not emerge from the wounds of time and history, that is not ruined by the lost infinitude within which it takes place without ever taking place. This means that the image testifies not only to its own impossibility, but also to the disappearance and destruction of testimony and memory. This is why, if the history and events sealed within these works call out for memory, this memory could never be a memory that aims to restore or commemorate. If we can no longer believe that memory and commemoration will help us prevent disaster in the future, however, we are still obliged to imagine a means of remembering what remains without remaining, what, destroying and consuming itself, still demands to be preserved, even if within a history that can never enter into history. If nothing can replace what has been lost to history, is it possible to interrupt the course of history and its catastrophes, or are we endlessly condemned to reiterate and enact this condition of loss and displacement? This question tells us not only why we must learn to read the past, to read, that is, the irretrievable images of the past, but in a way that knows how these images threaten to disappear to us as long as we do not recognize ourselves in them. But also, this is why, far from marking the end of the work of art, the works of Salvatore Puglia tell us why there are works of art, with impossible responsibilities and without end. What remains to be done, he tells us, is to collect and recollect the blurred noises around us, the sounds of what has disappeared, and to represent them. What remains is to collect the floating fragments of this history, to dig bones, documents, and to signal, to transmit them. What remains is the possibility of a gesture, to hand, to hold out, in the scattered memory to which we are doomed, some vestigia, some expressions of a multiple anamnesis, end quote. What remains are the fragments, the ruins of a corpus. Ashen glory, tears of Eros. Next, I mean, now we'll go. The work of art in the age of technological reproducibility. Music on bones. Music on bones, again. Square. I'll put my hand up and then I'll say the title again. Human figure. On cranial nerves. On cranial nerves. Vanitas. Civilization of the seal. Nina Nana, Handbook of Anamnesis, Premonitions, Steles. Okay, these are Steles. Move it back. These are up, sorry, backwards. These are Steles, the one behind it. Mobile Steles. Okay, the little wheels. Okay, then Steles. Fragments. As I Lay Dying. Essay on the Origin of Languages. Aurora. Lessons in Gravity. Antiquarium. Trophies. Oh, there should be two more, and that's it. Yeah. Trophies. No. Anyway, if it can't go, then there's one called Cinema, and then I wanted to end with Souls Purgatory. So. Oh, really? Okay, great. That we'll talk about the one that was next. In the discussion, that was going to be called Cinema, and then I was going to end with a recall of Souls of Purgatory, which I began with. Okay, thank you. I haven't actually.
Oh,
yeah.
There's some reference to Doug Kahn's book, which is either
In Wireless Imagination, or the book after on music.
Water, noise, meat,
oh, okay.
Thereof, he talks about several composers actually transcribe that line.
Ah, okay. Okay.
So.
Great.
Isn't there like that part in George Kahn's black game, which I think it's called music, like song bones on song or song?
I mean, I didn't know that. I mean, I did recently find out that there's a video that just is presumably just coming out or is about to come out in Japan on this practice, the music on bones. And there's a Japanese musician who is going to fly to Moscow and have his chest x-rayed and then is going to record his composition on the x-ray. So I'm in the process of trying to get a hold of this video, which is both in Japanese and English, otherwise I wouldn't be able to do it. But thank you for that. Other questions?
Did this artist actually use any of those x-rays? Where did the sound aspect of his work?
Well, Puglia actually was using x-ray film, old photographs, musical scores, things in his works. Before he found out about this practice. But he had an exhibition in St. Petersburg in 94, and people in St. Petersburg, on looking at his exhibition, told him about that particular practice, and then he entitled that exhibition Music on Bones. He did recently complete a film called Leaving Pictures, both Leaving Pictures Behind, but also Departing from Pictures. Which is actually this sort of bizarre, it's a film, one of the last images, actually the image that was attached to the last thesis was this image of the, I mean, maybe you could have maybe told what it was, these monuments that were covered. During the war in Italy, they would cover the monuments and pad them so that they wouldn't be destroyed with bombs and so on. He has this film, the entire film is a very slow, fuzzy reproduction of the shadowy figure playing, I mean, scratching with two turntables. And in the background are these fragmentary moving images of these monuments that are being covered. And then the soundtrack, with the exception, I think, of one song, they're all songs from the 40s in Italy. Except for I think it was Johnny Guitar, which is also sort of playing in the background and it's kind of distorted. So in some of the recent work, he's actually employed sound, but in the earlier work, it was mostly just, you see, it's all layered. These pieces are layered, and the superimposition of one image over another one, he would very often use musical scores in there and overlay them on the x-ray film, the photographs, and so on. So it was a kind of easy fit, I think, with this practice. Yeah. Any questions? Yeah.
I was I'm not sure if it's really a question, but I was kind of taken with the quote you offered about concern over the disappearance of matter in the X-ray.
Oh, with the Lenin.
I never really made the connections before, but I was thinking about, you know, like, sort of go with the rise of the ghost story in the 19th century, like Henry James's ghost stories, or the medium craze that's going on in the spiritualist movement.
Right.
Articles I've read about in the Atlantic Monthly about the spectrograph. And
right.
I never really put it together, but it seems like there must be a way to do that.
They're happening at the same time also. And actually, that's why it's too bad that we didn't get a chance to see cinema. I'm trying to write on the piece cinema, only on the piece cinema. And if I had the image, I could show it to you. It's driving me crazy, and I could use some help. But that piece is called cinema. And I mean, if I had a blackboard, I could draw it. But it's got... Okay, you saw how all of his pieces, or many of the pieces, this is a phase. I mean, this is, you know, Puglia began with painting, did the X-ray stuff, then went into latex, is now using, he's gone through different media, right? But while he was working on this phase with the X-ray films and the photographs and so on, most of the pieces were like the ones that I showed, where they have one bracket and one panel, right? Cinema has the bracket, but has two panels. And then in between the panels, there's a candle. And the candle reflects that image onto the wall, and the candle flame flickers. So voila, cinema. You know, you have the trembling image on the wall, right? But it's extremely complicated because of that double panel. I mean, I could go on forever about this, but so I won't. But what I'll say is that that piece, which is entitled Cinema, and which uses X-ray film in it, and old photographs and so on, is a piece that sort of demands that you read this sort of twin, triple birth. But actually the twin birth, let's say, in 1895 of cinema and the X-ray. I mean, some of you may know that the Lumiere brothers first exhibited their film in the latter part of 1895 within actually weeks of the Rankin discovery of the X-ray. So there have been a lot of people who've tried to talk about the sort of twin birth of film and the X-ray. And certainly with all the, as you said, the spiritual photographs and so on, a lot of the early films actually are skeletal images walking around. And so they were playing with X-rays. I'm trying to remember, there was an essay from a film historian from Chicago who tried to, it's a very short essay, he doesn't do much with it, but he does try and track the sort of double birth of cinema and... the X-ray. The Lenin quote is just, the Lenin text is amazing. It's this extremely long, very scientific essay where he just goes through all of the scientists who are talking about X-rays, and he just goes after them for talking about the disappearance of matter because he's like Mr. Matter, right? So it's a fantastic essay, actually. Yeah.
It's sort of a broader question that has to do with the status of your text or what you're doing. Because I felt that at times you were offering a sort of phenomenology of vision or sound that would be valid for absolutely everybody and the artist. And at times I felt that you were describing the artwork.
Right.
I was trying to ask first a simple question, which is, where is the specificity of Puglia's work there?
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, for instance, what he does echoes with, say, Boltanski or other people who've worked on art as a monumentalization of death and the Holocaust, Benjamin, and so on. So where is his somehow stylistic difference? And what are you then, let's say, how are you trying to inscribe something like a text in between, let's say, the phenomenology of art and the description of a very specific experience?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, one of the things that I, if I had actually been able to finish the reading of cinema, I would have given only a reading of cinema. Because there, part of what's difficult about reading the piece is just the materiality of these pieces. And I think that's what I like working about, working on these pieces. What I like about them is that they resist me in so many different ways. I mean, they're impossible to photograph, for example, because they're like sculptures. You know, they're on the wall, the panels turn. I mean, you could never see it in its entirety, right? Which is what I was trying to figure in some way in the beginning. What would it mean to see something that you cannot see? And which is what's asked of you because these pieces are part sculpture or whatever. So one thing that I was trying to do was since I didn't know how many people knew the Folia, I wanted to kind of show an array of pieces. The tact is a tricky one because usually, I mean, you know this probably, when I have written on images, I pick one. And I imagine I'm on a desert island. And this is the only image I have. And on the basis of this image, I have to produce a theory of the image, memory, history, etc. What can I do? And I love doing that stuff. You know. So what I was trying to do, so this is a kind of different mode of presenting this material. I guess one thing that I was trying to do, the transition is that in those moments when I take one photograph and try and develop a general theory of the image on the basis of that image, I'm trying to attend to the specificity of the image while at the same time developing a general theory of the image. Right? With these pieces, what I was trying to do at some level, since I wasn't, as I was showing them, I wasn't necessarily always letting you know which piece was which. Right? So that in some way the entire essay becomes a kind of caption for all the pieces, right? So that in some way I'm suggesting that everything that I say could be applied to all the pieces, right? Which is why they get inscribed in this way. And I would be happy to kind of talk about any single piece. But what I'm actually trying to do, and actually I like the question of what am I trying to do in the text itself as I try and write about this. And then I'll talk about his style and signature in relation to other artists. In my own work, what I like doing is performing in my writing what I want someone to understand. So in this book, what I've been trying to think about is what a book would look like if it came to you in the form of music, with all the echolalia, with all the sort of citationality, with all these sorts of things. That's a way for me to try and find a language, a way of writing and responding to these works that remains faithful to his own citationality. His texts are his pieces are totally citational. And I mean, one thing that again, if we had the cinema piece here, it not only cites the entire history of cinema, and in fact suggests that cinema began in prehistoric times, because there are maps of excavations of bones and maps of the first map we have. I mean, the first map we have, Betelina map, northern Italy, is in there. So it's the first kind of writing is also encrypted there. So it's cinema goes all the way back, beginning of time. That piece not only cites the history of cinema, but it also cites many of his own earlier works. And he constantly recirculates images from his work from one to another to another. So what I've tried doing, and that's why I mentioned in the beginning that I had incorporated parts of two theses from another essay. What I'm trying to do is figure out a way that I can mime this practice of superimposition, citationality, as a way of trying to engage what I think he does, right? In relation to figures like Boltanski and others, it's a very complicated relation, I think. In terms of his signature and style, Salvatore doesn't sign his works unless he thinks it's the kind of work that you would never recognize. So in other words, if it's a kind of work that is for him completely odd in relation to all the things that he produces, right? So that all these X-ray photographic pieces, none of them are signed. Because he, I think, thinks that if you see these things, you know they're his. So there's a way in which that signature for him is marked in the works, but at the same time, since it's scattered across all the texts and images that countersign his pieces,
There's a way in which what he tries to do is shatter the signature in some way, which is one of the reasons why he doesn't sign them. Right? So it's both, they're both marked and not marked at the same time. I guess I must say that in relation to Boltanski, I mean, my feeling, and I don't know, I can never put my finger on it, but I always know I'm going to need my whole hand in some way. There's a way in which I find Sawatoda's work more shattering than Boltanski. I mean, there's a way in which I think the motif of mourning in Boltanski becomes a means of reconstituting something that in Puglia's works gets more and more scattered. But that's just, you know, it's kind of an impression. And I've been, it's been harder for me to track influences in his work because there's so many. And I've spent a lot of time in his studio and looked through notebooks and so on, and it is impossible. I mean, there's just all, I mean, he has where he gets the things. But, you know, you ask him, or in the cinema piece, where was that excavation from? Well, it was in Kenya, the earliest excavation, the excavation of the earliest human remains that we have. I think it was in a book called Digging Up Bones, and you go track the book Digging Up Bones, and it's not there. Yeah, so there's itself a kind of staging of the relationship between memory and forgetting that he's trying to mark in the pieces. I don't know if this answers, kind of rambling way of answering, but I guess in terms of the performance, I'm trying to find a way in my own writing to replicate on a formal level what I see him doing in the work. I'm trying. It's very difficult, actually. Other questions? Yeah.
I was going to just hopefully ask a bit more about what you have in mind of music as sort of as book and this whole sort of project together, sort of composition. Just a bit passing through a bit in a way that, well, you extended music in numerous ways, including through the soul, so music as soul, music as sort of somewhat of a material, music as substance, and so it's, we saw sort of many different forms of music.
Right.
I'm just wondering if you could link it somehow to like something that Spinoza said about music, and then maybe that put this into question a bit, where he says, well, music can be three different things to different people. For someone who's static, it can sort of be a pleasurable experience. A pleasurable experience.
For someone who, what did you say?
Actually, I'm sorry. For someone that's static, it can be an annoying experience. For other people, it can be a pleasurable experience. And for the deaf person, it is no experience. How do you sort of basically, in other words, do you feel like you have to sort of stop music at a certain point to get these sort of distinctions, or can you make these distinctions? Like, how do you make your distinctions through these many different forms that you can?
That's a good question, and I mean, it's a question that I've been thinking about in relation to the form, but I don't know if I was, I mean, it's actually good to try and remind me of the way in which the word music gets mobilized within the lecture in different contexts, so that by the time you get to the end, as you say, it's sort of attached itself to a whole series of connotations. The primary one, of course, that I'm trying to think about is the relationship between writing and music. So the way in which music is itself a kind of inscription. And there, I think the reason I was trying to think about it in relation to soul, matter, etc., is that as someone who comes from literature, one of my tendencies is to turn just about anything that I'm looking at into a kind of text, you know, into some kind of inscriptional form, you know, so that if you, the work I've done on photography, for example, I'm interested in photography as a technique, a technology, and so on, but I'm also interested in the way in which, in the case of Benjamin, the way in which he uses photography as a lever to open onto different kinds of questions about reproduction, memorization, etc. That's kind of how I'm trying to think about music, and maybe this links to Jean-Michel's question, not only in terms of the specificity of art, but also the specificity of music, right? Because the way in which music itself, on the one hand, gets tracked within specific contexts, in the context of what this person or that person or this person says about music. But at the same time, music is something that is presumably, at least I'm trying, it's something that is marking and touching
hopefully most of the pages, right? So that music comes to be something that isn't, on the one hand, just music. On the other hand, I could say music is what it always is, which is music. So it's not music and is music at the same time. But what I mean by that is that it becomes attached to inscription, rhythm, the soul, the sort of a knot of our existence in some way. It becomes another. At one point, I make a translation and I say music means the vanishing of the subject. Right? And one way in which you could elaborate that, and which would be linked to what I think happens in the serialization of all these panels, is that when you listen to music, that music penetrates you, right? It inhabits you in some way. And from that moment, you're no longer the person you were before that penetration, right? So that you're altered by that. So it becomes a figure for an entry or lever into a theory of subjectivity, right? And the paradox, let's put it this way, the paradox of music would be something like this. Music tells you on the one hand that you are always in advance related to others, right? To something other. And on the other hand, because you're always related to others, you're never simply yourself. Right, which is why with music or with the gramophone, there are no writing subjects. I don't know if that answers. Yeah, I mean, I think the Spinoza passage, I don't remember. I guess one question you might say, well, why just death? Why just mourning? I mean, don't we get happy when we think music and so on? And I guess part of it is it has to do with my own, I don't know what to say. I mean, my own insistence on issues of finitude and mortality, but also the way I'm trying to mark music as a force or means of dispossession. And I mean, we talk about it that way, right? We are seized, we're taken over, we're overwhelmed, we're moved by music. And so what I'm interested in is what that means in relation to the stability or integrity of a subject. I think that happens at the level of these panels. All these pieces, none of those pieces ever just have one panel. Right? They're always in series. Right? So that means that they have to be understood. That piece, the pieces that compose that artwork, those panels have to be read in relation to one another. Right? Which means that each panel has its significance or meaning in relation to these other panels, but then again, because of its relation to all these other panels, its meaning never inheres only in itself, right? And that's, I guess, what I'm trying to think about also, is the way his work stages an issue of subjectivity and writing and music. Right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I have a question. I was wondering whether there was,
and
I don't know if we look very well, but
I don't either. It's hard. Of incest.
Right. The crossbones that sort of litter his work, I mean, it's sort of the crossbones that litter his work, right, seems to mark kind of this palimpsestuous taboo, if you will.
Oh, that's not bad.
Palimpsestuous.
I mean, you know, the taboo that sort of against sort of illicit reproduction, right? And I was just wondering, you know, if there was anything sort of, I mean, the incest, this kind of illicit reproduction, is also the thing that sort of initiates tragedy and death, like in Oedipus. And I was just wondering if Pooley was worth revisiting for that. Because as I was reading and listening to your lecture,
yeah,
I kept thinking about this coming back, because incest being sort of like troubling the idea of subject and other.
Right.
Also, you know, this sort of melting of the self that you were doing.
That's actually a great comment. I mean, I'm trying to think of. Of course, I mean, I want to rush to cinema, the piece cinema, which has the two panels, right? Okay, I mean, we need a blackboard. Okay, you've got a triangle. I mean, a rectangle. Okay, that's the front panel. Okay, you look at the front panel, and what you have is an upside down delta. Okay, which is in calculus a figure of differentiation. Okay, through that delta, you can see the candle flame, right? Now, that delta is also a figure for female genitalia, also, right? So your gaze looks through this figure for the origin of reproduction, differentiation, etc. The photograph that is layered there is a photograph of a family. Okay, and in fact, it's Puglia's family from the 1920s. Right? So you've got this image of a family. You've got this excavation from Kenya of the earliest human remains.
Right.
You've got this triangle, right? The back panel, and I'm giving you just some of the things that are in here, has the rectangle, a smaller rectangle. The photograph in there is also a family. Okay, and it's a Russian family from the 20s, so same period. And then you're, well, why the significance of that? Okay, it's between the two wars, but then it's between the two panels. So this is sort of a way in which then each panel becomes a kind of figure for the war, but you're looking through that triangle that is a figure for, it's almost as if he's saying the family is the origin of cinema, right? But you understand how the panels work. You've got these photographs, and since the panels can potentially flip around, they're transparent, they're x-rays, so on, these families are looking at one another, right? I mean, they're looking outward, but they're also looking backward. So there could be a way, I mean, I'm just improvising here, but it could be a way in which that gaze that goes through that triangle and that then presumably hits that other family, there is a kind of family, there's something going on in the relationship of those two families.
Those family portraits
in
his work, and I was wondering, you know, the quotes from Essay Wade, I don't know, maybe
you probably
know better which quotes you pulled from, because I couldn't
You're right, and that's how again, yeah, I mean, in Faulkner, incest is an enormous theme. I have to think about it, this is just an improvisation, but that piece is the one that I would move to first to try, I mean, not only because I'm working on it, but that's because it does seem that you've got these two families and you've got this triangle, which is a figure four, and then the gaze, which is kind of penetration. The other kind of incestuousness is probably this guy reads everything that we read. You know? He reads Derrida, Lacoulibart, Nolcy, Bataille, Faulkner, I mean, all the literary figures, and he encrypts them in his pieces. So there's a kind of incestuousness.
There's a breakdown of signification happens.
Yeah.
But somehow, I mean, to connect it with this discussion, at times, especially when I was expecting the reference to Rilke, I was being reminded of another theoretical debate between Bernard and Derrida in the 70s around the world of music.
And I haven't gone back to that, but you're right. I mean, the Rousseau, the reading of Rousseau.
The man, telling Derrida, you're wrong to accuse Rousseau of being a sort of romantic because he believes in music as origin, because music is already writing.
Right.
I think all this is there behind the technology.
Exactly.
This debate.
Yeah, exactly. And he has that piece, The Origin of the Essay of Languages.
Not to interrupt, but I invite us to move outside.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.